This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody. This is New Books in Psychology, and I'm your host, Eugenio Duarte, in Miami. Today, we're speaking with Walt Odets about his new book, Out of the Shadows, Reimagining Gay Men's Lives, published in 2019 by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. Walt Odets is a clinical psychologist and writer. His prior book is entitled In the Shadows of the Epidemic, Being HIV Negative in the Age of AIDS. He has also contributed chapters to 7 anthologies about the lives of gay men, and he lives in Berkeley, California, where he has practiced psychology since 1987. Walt, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I noticed that the title of your first book contains the phrase, In the Shadow, and your recent one is entitled, Out of the Shadows. Is this book a continuation of the first one?
Well, it is to some extent, because In the first book, we were in the middle of the epidemic, and there was a great deal I wanted to talk about in terms of gay men's lives, and I wasn't able to do it in that book. So I kept notes as I was writing that book, and I finally decided, with these two big boxes of notes, decided to write this last book. And it's much more about gay lives, broadly speaking, than gay lives in the middle of an epidemic.
So these were notes that you took about, you know, the everyday lives of gay men, maybe gay men in relationships, notes that you took of observations that you made during the pandemic, during the epidemic, that was a slip, but that I guess you felt constituted a story of their own, separate from the story you were telling at the time about the AIDS epidemic specifically?
Well, yeah. The current book, for example, discusses the whole idea of defining people as homosexuals or heterosexuals, which I think is a ridiculous idea. But that kind of exploration just wasn't appropriate in the first book, and the meaning of being gay was not appropriate. We were in the middle of an epidemic that was slaughtering people, and HIV negative people had a particular problem, which is that they were excluded from gay communities in many ways because they didn't have the problem. So it simply would have been inappropriate. And for anyone who reads the current book, the second one, you'll see that I discuss things, the developmental issues of gay people, the self-identities and so on. And that just wasn't material that fit into that earlier book. Incidentally, the HIV epidemic was a pandemic. It killed millions of people around the world, and I think about 350,000 in the United States. And it's still killing people. So
now, in your opening of this book, you name a few issues that you think gay men remain in denial about and which actually need to be addressed. And one of these issues is that the AIDS epidemic is not actually over. You say that we are currently in what you call, quote, the late epidemic, which started around 1996. Can you explain this point?
Yeah, well, I mean, it varies with people, but certainly there are there are many people who don't have medical insurance, can't afford it, and can't afford PrEP, the pre-exposure prophylaxis. And there's still a great deal of HIV infection around. It tends to be in disadvantaged communities. It's quite high in Black communities. And young people are still dealing with it. People who are too young to have ever lived through the early epidemic. And I think the problems are different for those young people, but there's the worst of the problems, I think, is that there's a huge amount of stigmatization of young people who contract HIV. And so it's a complicated situation. I could tell you a thousand things about it, but yes, there's still an epidemic going on.
Well, what is it that you are trying to say about it in this book, about the ways in which the epidemic is not over?
Well, I think the stigmatization, which is incidentally within gay communities in the early epidemic, the stigmatization was coming from American society. I write mostly about gay men in the U.S. because that's what I'm familiar with. Work. And there was a tremendous neglect. Ronald Reagan was president, and it was 6 or 7 years after the beginning of the epidemic before he ever publicly even mentioned the epidemic, much less try to do something about it. And so it's different now. The stigmatization is coming from within gay communities, young men stigmatizing other young men. And I think that young people have a fear about contracting HIV. They don't really know what it's like, and they try to avoid it. But they exclude those of their age range who do have HIV. So I think that's quite destructive.
I'm glad that you mentioned PrEP, the pre-exposure prophylactic, which is the medication that HIV negative people can take to prevent the acquisition of HIV. And look, I know a lot of gay men who feel that this medication signals the end of the AIDS crisis, because with this medication, they no longer have to worry about contracting the disease. What's your response to this idea?
Well, it's true. If you have medical insurance and you have the money to pay for the PrEP, and you have a community that in promotes the use of the PrEP drugs, they're very effective. And I think it's beyond very unlikely that someone who's regularly using PrEP would contract HIV. But we've got a huge part of American gay communities that simply can't afford the drug. And I think the U.S. government and insurance companies should be standing around on street corners just handing it out to people who are walking by. It's a humane thing to do, and it would also save a lot of money and a lot of medical costs.
But so are you suggesting that the AIDS crisis is not over to the extent that we have a situation where certain groups of people, the more privileged groups of people, yes, can have access to the medication, that prevents a transmission of HIV, but others do not. So really, is this late stage crisis that you talk about really a crisis inflected with racism and systemic bias?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So then how do we, in addition to thinking about this as a public health issue, if we think about it as a psychological issue, is this for people who are able to be, for gay men who are able to be on PrEP, should they care about HIV? Should they care about the history of the AIDS epidemic?
No, I don't think so. You know, I was born in 1947, and I didn't care about the Great Depression, you know, but there were adults around me who talked about that a great deal. So it's the early epidemic when it was completely out of control. We had no treatment. There were the first 4 years of that epidemic. We didn't even know what was being communicated. We didn't know if it was a virus, but if we did think it was a virus, we didn't know what virus. It was really in 1984 that, which started in 81, but in 84, we were finally able to identify it. And then it took another year, April of 85, before we were able to test for it. So it was a very different kind of situation then. And we went through some, you know, medications, AZT being the first of them. It came out in 1987. And it was not effective. It didn't protect people who had contracted HIV. So it's very different now, but it's still problematic for people who can't afford it. And it's not adequately promoted. There are certain physicians who actively promote it with patients, but there are a lot of people who don't have physicians.
Well, so I got to say, I'm a little surprised to hear you say that the people who do have access, unless I'm misunderstanding you, shouldn't care about the people that don't have that access. If that were the case, wouldn't that result in a divided gay male community?
It's divided. It's divided by the stigmatization. I think that the people who do have access should be much more supportive of people. Perhaps I didn't say that clearly, but yes, I think that's very important.
Do you work with people in your practice who, young people who have HIV, and do you have a sense from that work what it's like in the 21st century to have HIV and how it's different from before?
I have very little of that experience. And the reason is that I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. I live in Berkeley, 12 miles from San Francisco. And in this particular area, PrEP is very well promoted. And there are still people, of course. I know in Alameda County, the county I live in on the east side of San Francisco Bay, there's still a lot of new infection, but they tend to be groups that don't see people for psychotherapy, and partly because they're unfamiliar with it, partly because it's not part of their cultural system, partly because they don't have the money for therapy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I don't have that much experience with young people. I have a lot of experience with older people who have survived with HIV, what are called long-term survivors.
And tell us how do they see the present moment? You know, what do they think about where we are in the AIDS crisis?
I think it varies person to person, but I think the older men who are long-term survivors feel some relief. The epidemic now is a fraction of what it was in the 1980s and up through the mid 90s. It was a terror. It was like living in a war, and I think, you know, by comparison, the current pandemic of the coronavirus seems relatively mild to most of those people.
How so? Tell us more about that.
Well, it's not stigmatized in the way that HIV was stigmatized. You know, the what was going on with HIV from 1981 through like 96, 97 was fags get AIDS. And that was a big part of how the whole situation was treated. And it tended the kind of stigmatization and shame that people felt simply about being gay was only dramatically escalated by the HIV epidemic. And, you know, the idea that if they had a problem with HIV, well, then they shouldn't have sex. Well, human beings have sex, and that's something that has to be respected. Sex is an important part of human life. And so it's shifted. I'm not sure I'm quite answering your question here.
Well, I'm actually glad we're talking about this because I want to hear what you think about what it means for survivors of the AIDS epidemic in the 80s to talk about their experiences. When I lived in New York City, I used to run a study group for LGBTQ psychoanalysts and therapists where each month we'd have a speaker come talk to us about a different topic related to queer life. And one time I organized a presentation in which we revisited and discussed the AIDS crisis of the 80s, what it was like for people, how it affects them now. And even though most people found the discussion to be moving and rich, there was one senior therapist, a gay man who had been very involved in the 80s in treating AIDS patients, and who I am close to and look up to very much. He admitted that AIDS is a subject he simply does not like to talk about because it's too traumatic. And now that it's in the past, he doesn't feel much need to talk about it. I got to say, I was a bit stunned, you know, therapist to hear that, because as therapists, we never think that there's anything that can't and shouldn't be talked about. But he just felt like, why do we have to talk about this? It's too painful. Is that a feeling that you sympathize with or encounter yourself among older gay men?
I encounter it among older gay men all the time. And I used to be a pilot, so I'm part of a gay pilots group here in San Francisco. And we haven't done it this year because of the pandemic, but we can sit around that table, and I can tell by looking at some of the men, I can distinguish the ones who have HIV and those who don't. But so if there are 10 or 12 of us having lunch on Sundays, I have never heard the topic of the epidemic brought up. I'm very struck by that. And it simply was a trauma that no one wants to return to. And I myself think more about it. I wrote a lot about it. I did a lot of work. I worked for 15 years in HIV prevention, and the psychology that would help support the control of HIV. But it is something that what you just described is something I see all the time. People simply don't bring it up.
Do you think it's because you said it's still too traumatic? Do you ever think there's value or healing potential in raising the topic, in talking about it?
I think there is, and I'll give you an example of how I would act that out, is that I see an older man comes in for therapy and he's depressed. He feels his life is purposeless and he needs help with that. And part of the reason for all of that is that when he's, you know, now let's say he's, you know, 62, when he found out he had HIV, he was 28 and he assumed he'd never live. And he still doesn't believe that he has a future. It's very difficult to be told at the age of 27 or 28 that you're going to die within 6 months or so, and to survive that and return to a feeling that you have a life in front of you that you can use. So it's, you know, that's still a big problem. It was a very traumatic event. I had in my practice in the late 80s and into the 90s, I had one man die in the office during a session.
I believe you write about that in the book.
Maybe it's in there. I don't remember the book that well. But yeah, I'm sure I mentioned that. And I also had a group of HIV positive physicians. We did a weekly group, and I had four of them die in the same week. And I had a boyfriend at the time, and in those days we had pages. We didn't have cell phones. So for those who don't know, the page is a little box on your belt, and it tingles, and then there's a number comes up, and you have to call that phone number from a local phone. And we would go out to dinner. He was a physician. I was a psychologist. And we hardly ever had a dinner where one or the other or both of the pagers didn't go off. And, you know, in the middle of the dinner, we'd have to get up and go somewhere. It was very traumatic. And it wasn't, you know, my trauma wasn't my fear of contracting HIV and dying from it. It was the people I worked with, and it was my partner. I had a man I loved very much. We were together for 7 years. He died in 1992. And I went through the last year of his life. It was absolutely horrible. And that's something I'll never get over. I can draw up images of him lying in bed, immobilized. And so that people don't want to talk about this is understandable. I talk about it because, you know, my work, as you know from yours, is that it's helpful very often to get people to talk about disturbing things.
Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You know, another issue you address in the book and that you say we are in denial about is the continuing struggle faced by many gay men today, given how much progress we appear to have made. Can you talk to us about how being gay is still a difficult and sometimes traumatic experience for some men?
Yeah, I think in terms of the total society and the presentation of a certain kind of media. So I'm talking about the New York Times or the New York Book Review, you know, those kinds of things. Being gay doesn't have any meaning to it. It's just simply people. But the family is a much more important influence than the society as a whole. And I would say that a majority of young gay people grow up in unaccepting families, and that's still true. I gave a talk in New York, I think it was at the end of last year, and there was a young guy in the audience, you know, maybe 30 years old, and he said, "I don't know, you know, why you think that that gay people have such a difficult time now." And I said, "Well, where do you live?" And he said, "I live in Manhattan." "Did you grow up there?" "Yes, I grew up in Manhattan." And I said, "Have you ever been to Staten Island?" He said, "Oh, no, I'd never go there." You know, well, Staten Island is pretty much, homophobic. And if you then take the rest of the United States and, Alabama and Minnesota and I don't know what. And I mean, there's a huge amount of stigma. And an unsupportive or hostile family is very damaging. And I still think that we have a majority that falls in that direction.
A majority, you think?
Oh, yeah.
So then,
families, yes. I mean, the families, most families are not reading the New York Times. They're not reading the New York Book Review. They're acculturated in a different way. And what we see, I mean, I don't read local newspapers. I don't read the, Minnesota Star or something like that. I read the New York Times or the Washington Post. Well, being gay is fine if you read those two newspapers. But most people are not reading that kind of material. And they feel a great deal of shame and hostility about gay people.
So do you have any theory about why homophobia persists?
Well, I've been thinking about that for decades. And I don't know why it ever started. It's actually a relatively recent problem. And it was in the late 19th century when the word homosexual was first used. And it began to define people, men who had relationships with other men. It began to define them as a group. So this whole idea of gay men as an identity and a significant one is actually relatively recent. Maybe starting in, the early 20th century and, 1910, 1920, sort of in there. And in the first chapter of the book, what I'm talking about is the title of the chapter is "Are Gay Men Homosexuals?" And my answer to that is no. Gay men are people who have relationships and an attachment with other human beings. And some people have attachment with people of the same gender. And that's really the issue. I think gay men are more interesting than straight men because I think they have a much broader, much deeper internal life because they've had to think about things. But people can't be defined by whom they have sex with. It doesn't make any sense. The attachment, one man's attachment to another man gets expressed sexually because that's one of the important ways that human beings express feelings for another person.
But are you, so by that way of conceiving of what it means to be gay, are you, like, can a person be gay without being homosexual? In other words, can a person be gay even if they don't have sex with or romantic relationships with someone of the same sex?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there are people who are relatively asexual. I think that's, fairly rare. But certainly there are men, and I've known some, who are emotionally attached to other men but aren't sexual with them. They also aren't sexual with women usually.
Is there such a thing then as a man who, let's say, is married to a woman, but by virtue of his interests or by virtue of other characteristics, he'd qualify by your definition as gay?
Yeah, sure. I hear about that all the time. I've had over the years a handful, I don't know, five or six young gay men who work as sex workers. So, essentially rent boys, as they would say in London. And what I heard from them always was that their clients were always straight men who were married to women.
So, but wouldn't that be someone, what's the difference between that kind of person or someone who's gay, but on what they say on the down low?
Well, they're in the closet. as the saying goes. And I think that there are also bisexual people. There's no question. I think human beings are by nature bisexual, and that social constructions kind of deny that. But yeah, I mean, there. I don't think this has to be defined. I don't think we have to define people as gay or not gay or bisexual or not bisexual, unless, you know, we're just talking about statistics or something. But in terms of emotional life is complex. When I was young, I had sex with women. And I grew up in a certain kind of family that made that a completely non-issue. Mm-hmm. Whom one had sex with, but I loved a couple of those women. I turned 30, I thought, no, I really kind of wanted to spend my life with men, and I didn't say to myself I want to be gay, because I don't know, my parents had all kinds of friends who men who lived with men. My middle name is Whitman, so I'm named after Walt Whitman. And When I was a kid, you know, maybe 10 years old, I asked my father about it. And one of the things he told me about Walt Whitman was that he lived with a man. I think he said something like, you know, he lived with a man the way a lot of men live with women. That's something you make your mind up about when you're older. And so I didn't decide at 30 to become gay or to come out. I decided that I wanted to live with men.
I'm very interested in the way that you describe it in the book. You call it a gay sensibility. You say that gay men possess this gay sensibility. What defines, or what are the hallmarks of the gay sensibility?
Yeah, that's a complicated question with a complicated answer. But what I'm talking about there is a kind of emotional breadth and depth that is taken away from males in their very early age. You know, the obvious one being boys don't cry. Well, when we're infants, when we're 2 years old, 3 years old, our emotional lives, the emotional lives between males and females are very, very similar. And boys are taught not to behave that way. And it's a social construction that I think is destructive, because it limits the lives of people. Most of my very close friends, the ones with whom I can really talk intensely about emotional issues, almost all of them are women. And men have a great difficulty with that. They're very uncomfortable with that.
So these women also possess the gay sensibility, you think?
Yeah, I think they have more of what we'd call a female sensibility. That gay men have a mix of what we would call a female sensibility and a male sensibility. So it's some kind of mix. But it's broader than that of most so-called straight men. People have to think about themselves and think about who they are. You know, a 14-year-old in puberty has to think about how he relates to other people, why he, you know, wants to touch another boy in school, and has to think about how others are going to read that kind of behavior. So it's a kind of an emotional self-exploration that other boys don't have. Other boys are out there throwing baseballs around and hitting each other, you know, throwing beer bottles at each other. It's a very different experience.
You point out in the book that there is a danger or a cost when gay men describe themselves to straight individuals as something like, oh, I'm just like you. The only difference is that I'm attracted to men, but otherwise we're the same. What's the cost of this kind of thinking?
Well, I think it constricts and narrows lives. It's you know, what I would call normalization. People try to normalize themselves. I think the marriage thing there are a lot of good points to gay people being married. But some of it is just an effort to socially normalize oneself. And I think, you know, Pete Buttigieg, whom I kind of like, he's a completely normalized gay man. And I think it limits a life. I think life can be more interesting than that.
You mean that you think he's limiting his life, or that it limits the lives of other gay men by virtue of his, I guess, heightened visibility?
Well, I think he's a model, and I think there a lot of people appreciate his normalizing being gay. So, you know, the people are thinking, Pete can be gay, I can be gay, and that'll be okay. And I think it's narrowing. People have to make their own choices about that. I think there are good people reasons for people to get married, but I think there are also some that that damage lives. There was I can't remember the name of the organization. It's the big, you know, gay organization, but they were sending out solicitations, and I got one from them where they were promoting gay marriage before the Supreme Court allowed it. And they said something like, it's important that gay people get married so that they can return to their communities and be valued as community members. Well, that bothers me.
Why?
Because I don't think that's why someone should get married. I think that if you have to get married and disguise yourself as a normal person because you're married, and that's the only way that you can have a community or get along with other people, it's too narrow.
You know, it's funny because I tend to agree with you, and I sometimes myself wonder if even heterosexual couples in some way limit themselves by virtue of participating in the institution of marriage, or at least the way it's construed these days.
Was that a question?
No, I wonder if this is, if what you're describing, I guess my question would be, do you think that what you're describing is limited only to gay people, or is there something about any kind of normalization, any kind of institutionalization, sure, that is always going to have some kind of limiting, constraining effect?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think life should be constructed by communities or by cultures or societies. And there's much more potential in life. You know, in America, half of legal marriages end in divorce. And I would think that half of those that don't end in divorce ought to end in divorce. You know, they're unhappy. So, you know, maybe I'm making up the figure, of course, but I mean, maybe a quarter of marriages are a great idea.
Well, Walt, it's been a pleasure to talk to you about the book. We're almost out of time, but I didn't want our time to end without my finding out from you what you're up to these days, what you're working on now.
Well, I'm still doing, I do my practice 2.5 days a week, and I'm recovering from having written that book and promoted it. It was an exhausting experience. Mm-hmm. I started the writing of the book in 2014, and it was published in 2019. So it was a tremendous amount of work, the writing and then the aftermath, the editing and all of that. So I sit around and read, I watch movies, I walk the dog, that kind of stuff. I spend a lot of time with friends, less so right now, of course, because of the pandemic. I'm relaxing. I think that's the gist of my answer.
Well, it's really well deserved, and I want to thank you again for coming on the show. I want to remind our listeners of the name of your book. It is Out of the Shadows, Reimagining Gay Men's Lives, and my guest has been Walt Odets. Walt, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate our doing this.
Take care.